The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic Traveler and AAA Go Magazine. And before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in our articles. They are selected for your enjoyment and edification. And today we're going to start by heading to the Old West, where award-winning writer Andrew Nelson explains why he's praising Arizona from the February-March 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And as the article's caption headline states, the sky's the limit in a state graced with elemental energy, creative spark, and small-town flair. Whitewashed churches, red rock canyons, and pink blossoms cacti, green stick Palo Verde trees, Navajo turquoise, and swell-elegant resorts. Discoveries crop up everywhere in the 48th state. A deep cultural heritage, Mexican to Anglo, Hopi to hipster, flavors Arizona's communities. Cities shimmer with possibilities, from bike tours and art walks to street fairs and fiestas and rodeos. Wilderness lies so close you can go from skyscraper to Cerro in 0 to 60. There are canyons, this is the Grand Canyon State after all, deserts, mesas, and a startling number of lakes, creeks, and swimming holes that invite all sorts of water fun. Arizona teems with treasures. Begin your journey in what locals consider the eighth wonder of the world, the vast sandstone basin of Monument Valley. Culture Quilt, Monument Valley Navajo Tribal Park. So this is where God put the West, John Wayne reportedly said when he arrived in Monument Valley to film Stagecoach. The 1939 Western, the first of dozens of movies shot here, elevated Wayne to star status and established Monument Valley as a cinematic symbol of the Old West. The silver screen version of this canyon's lands, sandstone buttes, mesas, and arches, pales in comparison to the grandeur of the real thing. Straddling the Arizona-Utah border, 91,696-acre Monument Valley Navajo Tribal Park is a sacred place to the Dene, the Navajo term for the Navajo people. Our elders say the valley is like a sitting hogan, says Rosalind Crank, referring to the traditional Navajo mud and wood dwelling. Crank grew up in Monument Valley and hosts guests nearby at her Mother Earth Hogan Airbnb. The walls in the valley sort of echo the walls of the hogan, and in the center is the hub, like the stove in the center of a hogan. Some also have considered the two iconic notched buttes known as the Mittens to be the hands of a deity. Venturing to the center of the tribal park or anywhere off the main 17-mile loop road requires a Navajo guide like Ray Begay. My grandma and my mom always tell us if you're going up early at dawn and out here, you will get good things in return, Begay says, gazing over the valley. At times when I guide, there is a medicine man who sings morning prayer. It's a beautiful song. Insider tip, to experience this sacred place that the Navajo called the Sebi Nizagai, or Valley of the Rocks, on an overnight trip to Hunts Mesa, where you'll be treated to a better-than-silver-screen sunset before camping out under the stars. Monument Valley may be one of the most photographed locations in the world, but it remains steeped in American history and lore. And just some of the things to see, festivals, foods, and flights of fancy. Hopi Native Art and Cultural Festival. September's annual Hopi Native Arts and Cultural Festival offers a window into the traditions of a people who guard their privacy and serve as protectors of Mother Earth. Held in Flagstaff's Heritage Square, the festival connects Hopi artists, basket weavers, potters with the outside world and with Hopi families. The festival helps inspire our younger ones, says events coordinator Lisa Taya Umtrawa, and keeps us stronger as a tribe. Barrio Viejo, Tucson. The Barrio Viejo, or Old Quarter, is the traditional heart of Tucson's Mexican-American community. Its 250 adobe and territorial-style buildings, some from the 1850s, are quintessentially and distinctly Tucson, says local preservationist Demian Cinco. cruise its streets with Tucson bike tours, then lunch at Five Points Market and Restaurant. Purveyor of farm-to-table foods. Bunk at the downtown Clifton, a period hotel that stocks 1950s pulp fiction and rentable record players. Horseshoe Bend Slot Canyon. Northern Arizona's slot canyons are the stuff of photographers' dreams. Wave-like sandstone passages, swirls of color, ethereal beams of light. And Antelope Canyon, near the town of Page, gets the buzz, but you'll be as wowed by nearby Horseshoe Bend Canyon, also known as Secret Canyon. Only Navajo-owned Horseshoe Bend Slot Canyon Tours is allowed to lead small groups through the 450-foot-long formation, which tour manager Tim Bryan calls one of the most magical, surreal, and simply beautiful places on Earth. Yuma Territorial Prison State Park. Desperados and other outlaws did time at Yuma Territorial Prison from 1876 to 1909. The Blufftop Jail was considered a bit of a country club, says Arizona State historian Marshall Trimble, noting that prisoners were well-fed and could learn a trade. However, visitors get a real sense of the loneliness in the cells as they walk an original cell block. And unlike stagecoach bandit Pearl Hart and her fellow inmates, visitors can leave at will. No escape plan needed. Now we're on to looking at small charms. Ajo. Drive south of Gila Bend toward Mexico on Highway 85, and several clues suggest the approaching town of Ajo as far from typical. At mile marker 29, cell signals begin to fade. By marker 35, wildlife is abundant enough that drivers are cautioned with a watch for animal sign. Ajo, surrounded by 12 million acres of federal lands, including the nearby Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, is no stranger to coyotes, javelinas, and travelers intrigued by its possibilities. As you pull into this Sonoran desert community, your phone revives, but you'll be too curious about the town's revival to pay attention to it. Ajo saw its population crater after the 1985 closure of its chief industry, copper mining. Left behind was a stunning array of Spanish Revival buildings, including the Curley School, now a classrooms-to-guest-rooms haven for artists and other creative souls. Warning, seduction happens fast here. Boston natives Emily and Stuart Siegel have embraced their new town with the enthusiasm of earlier pioneers. We're an eclectic cast of characters, says Emily, who oversees the Sonoran Desert Inn and Conference Center, housed in the former school. The inn's 21 rooms frame a courtyard where 26 pomegranate fruit trees flourish, another sign of this desert town's renaissance. Ajo is just one of many Arizona enclaves, from 1880s ghost towns to Mad Men era districts offering a smile and a sense of place. These four communities promise their own experiences. And here are some of the towns that weave their own magic. Jerome. Welcome to the Mile High City, says the receptionist at the Grand Hotel in tiny Jerome. We just don't say that to Denver folks perched on Cleopatra Hill. This mining town between Prescott and Flagstaff was flush with copper ore revenue until the mine closed in 1953. Saved by 1960s hippies, Jerome's western-style buildings house restaurants such as the Turquoise Spider, big on altitude with no attitude. Paradise Gardens, Phoenix. Phoenix buildings are off the hook, says Allison King of Modern Phoenix, a group preserving mid-century architecture in Arizona's capital. Case in point, Paradise Gardens, a 1960s quarter celebrated for that era's clean-lined style. Attributed to architect Al Beadle, the residence's designs were inspired by native plants. For more, take King's tour. A bonus, her website, modernphoenix.net, that's modernphoenix.net, has maps of Phoenix mod heritage. And then there's Bisbee. Bisbee is a magnet for eccentrics, says photographer Zoya Green of this town's mix of healers, hippies, performers, and artisans. Unleash your inner creative at a Bisbee Craft School workshop. Then spot zany sculptures and art cars along the staircases of the Bisbee 1,000 Great Stair Climb. Cap things off with a night in a 1947 yacht, one of 10 rooms at the Sandy Dell Vintage Trailer Court. And finally, Williams. Before interstates, the town of Williams was a stopover on Route 66. Williams' stretch of the 2,448-mile Mother Road hit its neon-lit prime in the 1950s and 60s. When I-40 bypassed town in 1984, locals rallied to preserve their Route 66 heritage centered on the historic downtown district. Says Mayor John Moore, Williams harks back to a simpler time. Today, get your kicks on this Route 66 at Twister's, a 1926 Texaco station turned diner. Oh, my, my, my. And let's see what else is in store for us as we enjoy this tour of the 48th state. And the next one is Liquid Assets. You ready? Birdie River. River guide Melissa Edwards keeps her armada of 14 kayakers moving. She knows it's easy to be distracted by the natural splendor of the Birdie River and lower your paddle. The reeds and wild grapevines on its banks are a luscious green. Where the water narrows, the arcing cottonwoods and alder trees offer cool shade. Songbirds flit in the dappled sunlight. Edwards has navigated the Birdie for 9 years and would never trade in her paddle, not even for a Scottsdale swizzle stick. Keep your city, she says with a laugh as she noses her kayak into the current. This is beautiful. It's hard to believe that this wild water world is in Arizona, but the Birdie River, which courses one for 125 free-flowing miles, is just one of the eye-openers for visitors who equate the state with the Sonoran Desert. From tubing to lake sailing, there is an Arizona Yacht Club, to jumping into your pick of swimming holes, Arizona has a raft of choices for cooling off. Another option, the rinse of a glass, the rattle of ice, and the fashioning of a Canyon Red Craft cocktail at Counterintuitive, an artful bar in Old Town Scottsdale. We push the envelope for cocktails, says co-owner Jason Asher, who often uses Arizona ingredients in his recipes. An old-fashioned features Tucson-made whiskey Del Bac. Plunge into more of Arizona's waters in these four desert dives. And then as we go on to the western land wetlands, here are some suggested places. There's Watson Lake, Mother Nature bought the rocks, Granite Creek's dam added the water. The result, Watson Lake, a liquid interval in the Granite Dells outside Prescott. Built in the early 1900s for irrigation, the man-made reservoir is popular for recreation, excluding swimming. From spring into fall, Prescott Outdoors rents kayaks, canoes, and stand-up paddleboards to explore the lake's secluded coves to cruise along the scenic, bouldered shoreline. Then there's the crack on Wet Beaver Creek. Blowing up your Instagram is only half the fun of dipping into the crack on Wet Beaver Creek. The cheekily named swimming hole sits on the 160,000-acre Red Rock Ranger District, south of Sedona. Reaching the crack means hiking some 7 miles, that's round trip, on Bell Trail number 13. The rewards from cliff jumping into deep water to sunning on rock slabs to giving your friends a severe case of FOMO are well worth the trip. And what is FOMO, you might add? F-O-M-O means fear of missing out, or anxiety, if you will. Then there's Emerald Cave. True to its name, Emerald Cave is a jewel along the Black Canyon National Water Trail, a 30-mile route in the Lake Mead National Recreation Area. To see Emerald Cave's trademark green glow, visit early to mid-afternoon in spring or fall. Inside the cave on a windless afternoon, the water is absolutely still and the light streaming through the entrance. It's dreamlike, says kayak Lake Mead owner Robert Finley, who heads custom Black Canyon paddling trips. And then finally, the Ritz-Carlton Dove Mountain. It's no mirage. That is an oasis in the Sonoran Desert just north of Tucson. The 850-acre Ritz-Carlton Dove Mountain Resort gens up a watery trifecta, a splash-and-play main pool, a sip-and-chill infinity pool, and a serenity pool complete with tanning island. Plunge into the main pool on a 235-foot-long water slide, designed to blend in with the desert as it snakes around boulders and cacti. At sunset, slide into the infinity pool and sip a margarita from the poolside turquoise Latin grill as the sky blushes into pinks and crimsons. Ooh, really makes you want to head to the southwest, huh? Well, next, writer Christy Tolley is going to offer a tale of an old-school odyssey to Memphis with her Elvis-loving dad. Her article, Going to Graceland, is in the March-April 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine. Shall we begin? Road tripping to Memphis to visit Graceland has long been on my travel wish list, and last year my dad and I made it happen. Armed with our AAA triptych and an epic Elvis Presley playlist, we hit the road. We stayed at the newly opened guest house at Graceland, conveniently situated across from Graceland. It was a perfect home base for our local excursions. You won't find any photos of Elvis in the hotel, save the gift shop, but you'll see nuances of him through the photography and decor. Chair backs in the lobby are reminiscent of the collars on Elvis's rhinestone jumpsuits, and stylized photos of items that belonged to Elvis adorn the richly hued walls. Dining options include EP's Bar and Grill and Delta's Kitchen. We love the contemporary take on some of Elvis's favorite dishes in EP's, and we just about ate our weight in those decadent southern biscuits at Delta's. Now, she's got this broken down into three parts. Day one, our first full day in Memphis was largely spent at Graceland. Total touring time for us was about 5 hours, and I honestly felt like I would have stayed longer. We took the Elvis Entourage VIP tour. It included a mansion tour with full access to the new Elvis Presley Memphis Entertainment Complex, which housed Elvis Discovery Exhibits, Presley Motors Automobile Museum, Elvis the Entertainer Career Museum, and exclusive VIP exhibit. Built in 1939 and completed in 1941 by local physician Dr. Thomas Moore and his wife Ruth, Graceland was named after Ruth's aunt, Grafe Toof. Elvis purchased the mansion and a 13.8-acre estate in 1957 for $100,000. About 600,000 people visit Graceland each year, making it the second most visited home in the U.S. behind the White House. Walking through Graceland was like exploring a 1960s and 1970s era time capsule. Over-the-top design and colorful kitsch abounded throughout, and it's glorious. From the jungle room, family room complete with Polynesian furnishings and a working waterfall to the vibrant yellow and black TV room, with three TVs and a funky monkey, it was hard to pick a favorite. Even if you aren't an Elvis fan, it's difficult not to be inspired by his rags-to-riches story. He embodied the American dream, and Graceland's extensive displays of letters, clothing, photos, and other memorabilia bring Elvis's journey to life. By the end of the tour, I realized that even though Elvis's career spanned only 23 years, he packed a remarkable amount of life and work into that time. After some post-Graceland tour downtime at the hotel, we headed to Catherine and Mary's for dinner. Named after the chef's grandmothers, Catherine and Mary's is one of the most successful restaurants opened by Andy Ticer and Michael Hudman. The two chefs pay further homage to their grandchildren with their brilliantly executed Tuscan and Sicilian-inspired cuisine. With a monthly changing menu, an impressive wine list, and handcrafted cocktails, it's easy to see why it's a local favorite. The Elvis Collection, or rather the Elvis Connection, let me put it that way. Catherine and Mary's is in the former Chiska Hotel, where on July 8th, 1954, Elvis Presley hit the airwaves for the first time. Popular disc jockey Dewey Phillips played Presley's recording of That's All Right on his radio show Red Hot and Blue. Listeners went nuts. Dewey played the song 13 times in a row and coaxed Presley to the studio for an on-air interview. Dewey's original radio booth was salvaged from the Chiska building and is on display at Sun Studio. Now on to day two. Pairing my dad's two favorite things, anything Elvis and classic cars, we toured Memphis in the best possible way in a baby blue and white 1955 Chevy Bel Air Rockabilly Rides Red Hot and Blue Tour of Elvis's Memphis. Fun and extremely informative. The owner, Brad Burkdale, drove us by the local Elvis landmarks like L.C. Humes High School, where Elvis graduated, Lauderdale Courts, his family's first Memphis apartment, and the Levitt Shell, where Elvis gave his first paid concert in 1954. Along the way, Brad shared lesser-known Elvis stories that even my dad hadn't heard before, and he provided insight into other Memphis attractions and restaurants. And then on to day three. You can't have a true Elvis experience in Memphis without savoring a fried peanut butter and banana sandwich, one of Elvis's favorite dishes, at the Arcade Restaurant, so we began our day with breakfast there. Although it's known for being one of Elvis's favorite dining spots, with his own secluded booth by a back entrance, this historic diner is also Memphis' oldest restaurant. Opened in 1919 by Greek immigrant Spiros Tsipras, the arcade is still family-owned and the place to go for a hearty southern breakfast, slap-your-mama-good cheeseburgers, and a variety of pizzas and salads. Fully sated from our breakfast platters and our side order of PB&B, we made our way to the Sun Studio, quite possibly the world's most famous recording studio, and often dubbed the birthplace of rock and roll. It was the spot of the first true rock and roll recording, Rocket 88, by Jackie Brenston and Ike Turner. Listed on the National Register of Historic Places, Sun Studio helped launch the careers of the likes of B.B. King, Johnny Cash, and Roy Orbison. The first room was lined with glass cases filled with studio memorabilia, vintage recording equipment, photos, posters, Elvis's Social Security card and diploma on loan from Graceland, and other items. You'll also find Dewey Phillips' reassembled office and sound booth. Our guide weaved the Sun Studio story with recordings of Elvis's My Happiness, Rufus Thomas's Bear Car, and Just Walking in the Rain by the Prison Airs. Fun fact, the Prison Airs were escorted by armed guards to the studio from prison to record the song in 1953. Two of the members of the group were eventually granted a full pardon. The second part of the tour was in the actual recording studio section of the building, which included Marion Kiesker's office. Kiesker, the studio secretary, is credited with launching Elvis's career. She was working that day in 1953 when Elvis arrived to record songs for his mother as a birthday gift. She encouraged him to return and perform for Sam Phillips, Sun Studio's owner. At the end of the tour, we were given the chance to ham it up with an old-school studio microphone that was salvaged from the original building. For dinner, we made an appointment for a meal at the Beauty Shop, a hip restaurant located in the Cooper Young District. The building was once Atkins Beauty Salon, Priscilla Presley's curl and dye spot, and the restaurant pays empty homage to the 50s-era beauty shops, or campy homage, I should say, not empty, pays campy homage to the 50s-era beauty shops. I dined under a hooded Belvedere hairdryer by vitrolite walls, both original fixtures from the salon. Does that create quite a picture for you? Now we're heading home. We couldn't very well drive through Tupelo, Mississippi and pass by the Elvis Presley birthplace without visiting, so we hit the road early to make time for the stop. The complex is comprised of Elvis's original home place, the church he attended growing up, a museum and gift shop. The white-frame two-room home was stark contrast to Graceland and amplified my sense of awe in Elvis's accomplishments. The museum showcased original clothing, belt buckles, photos, and other personal items belonging to Elvis, many of which were from the private collection of Janelle McComb, a close family friend. Wow. Talk about fun, huh? Well, with the arrival of April comes the start of baseball season, and many people will be including trips to the ballpark to enjoy the American pastime. One of the most popular destinations for many baseball fans is Chicago's Wrigley Field. Now, Chicago Tribune writer Paul Sullivan recently wrote a commentary, "If the old Wrigley Field dugout walls could talk," and it was published in the March 22, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. So get ready and let's play ball. Our dateline is Mesa, Arizona, where the article was written. The Cubs eased concerns of a repeat of the start of the 2015 season when they announced the latest Wrigley Field renovations will be completed in time for the April 9th home opener. No worries about the bleachers being done or the bathrooms malfunctioning on opening day. All systems are go, so to speak. Cubs business president Crane Kenny on Thursday gave a brief rundown of the latest improvements, including more concession stands with grill capability, better cell service, and ultimately faster Wi-Fi. Two new elevators and a comfy premium hangout for big spenders called the American Airlines 1914 Club. But the biggest change will be in large dugouts, which will be 28 feet further away from their old spot, Kenny said. As far as most fans are concerned, renovated dugouts probably are the least controversial change at Wrigley, which has added video boards, patio sections, and bullpens underneath the bleachers during the early phases of the renovation. It will take a little getting used to, like lowering the brick wall behind some plate years ago, but this one change that seemingly doesn't bother even the traditionalist. Cubs manager Joe Madden came to the North Side in 2015 when the new video boards were introduced, ending the video-free era Wrigley Field. He recalled how controversial it was to some fans, adding, "But now they probably can't live without them." Will the new dugouts make a difference for the people inhabiting it, or are they just another in a series of alterations changing the look of Wrigley Field? "A good dugout matters," Madden said. "A comfortable dugout matters. You know, I like to stand at the corner, closest to the plate, like I do. But guys, when you're not on top of each other, it just helps the moment. I'm curious to see what that looks like." It's very perceptive and forward-thinking because I would prefer updating an old ballpark as opposed to tearing it down and building a new one, because you're never going to replicate the beauty of that place, the ambiance there. It's impossible to recreate that, he said. Cubs Hall of Famer Billy Williams said a newer and expanded dugout is better for the players, and he pointed out it was considered small even back when he was playing during the 1960s and early 1970s. "You had guys coming up in September and they had to sit on the cement near the hat racks," he said. "It was a small dugout, but of course Wrigley had been there 100 years and it was the same dugout." Williams said he had a regular spot on the far end of the bench, and manager Leo DeRocher sat next to the water fountain. Everyone knew their spot, and protocol dictated no one sat where one of the regulars liked to go on a daily basis. Williams said he had a good reason for sitting where he did. "We were playing all-day games, and I could get a little breeze up there," he said, "plus the fact I'd get me a cigarette, and in those days I was smoking, so I would bend over and hide from the umpires, hide from everybody." Well, Leo didn't mind, but owner P.K. Wrigley saw it one day, and he called out to the ballpark and talked to Leo about it. "If you're having a good year, you want to stay consistent with that," he said. "Funny story, you know how Ron Santo was? You would see the vein in his neck when he would get mad at anything. One day, they put in a tube of six bat rack, and Santo popped up with a runner on something, came back, and smashed it with the whole thing shattered. They fixed it by making a steel one, painted it red so it looked like wood. We come back off the road trip. Santo gets mad at making it out and tries to smash it, and it didn't break. He got mad at that and just threw his bat down." Only in baseball, right? Of course, Santo wasn't alone. We also saw Carlos Zambrano smash the water fountain with a bat, along with the Gatorade dispenser. And there was also an occasion when he punched Michael Barrett in the face, sending his catcher to the hospital. If only those dugout walls could talk. Talk about fun. Only in baseball will you have stories like that, I'm afraid. But that brings us for a quick check of some things happening in the April travel calendar. This from the March-April 2016 AAA Go magazine calendar. April 13th through 14th, the Classic Antique Power Farm Heritage Days. This is at Benson Chamber Park in Benson, North Carolina. A large display of antique tractors, farm equipment, parade of power, and more. And there is a fee involved, and you can check it all out at johnstoncountync.org. johnstoncountync.org. And then April 20th, through the 28th, Art Fields in downtown Lake City, South Carolina. The area's largest art competition and exhibition, open to Southeastern artists age 18 and older, and a fee is involved. And you can get more information if you'd like to attend Art Fields in downtown Lake City, artfieldssc.org. Again, that is artfieldssc.org. And then in Aiken, South Carolina, April 21st, we have the Earth Day Aiken, which includes a family bicycle ride. And that brings us to the end of another great edition of Armchair Travel. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have questions or comments, direct them to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.